And at the time that other universities were announcing their paid degree programs, MIT said, with our own money, we are going to record every class at MIT, and we're just going to share it for free for the world. And so when Khan Academy a few years later was catching on and I was getting letters from folks saying I was helping them, I almost felt dirty if I didn't hold myself to the same standard that MIT had held itself to.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hi, my name is Simon Brown. I'm one of the co-authors of the book The Curious Advantage. And today I'm here with my co-authors, Paul Ashcroft.
Hello.
And Garrett Jones.
Hi there.
And we're delighted to be joined by a true pioneer in the education world, Sal Khan, founder of Khan Academy. Welcome, Sal.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. And great to be talking again. So I'd like to kick us straight off with a super topical question. So many people are arguing that generative AI and ChatGPT is going to be the death of education. But you've just released a great TED Talk, and I'd urge our listeners to go and check it out, saying how AI is going to positively transform education. So can you share with us why you're so excited about AI and ChatGPT and some of the things you've been doing with it?
Yeah, the best example I could find, I'm pretty proud of this metaphor. I'm sure other people have come up with it, but you know, it's kind of like in the mid-19th century, many people did say that when the camera came about, that it was the death of art, because it could now do something far better and far faster and far cheaper than any portrait artist could ever do. But in some ways, some people almost consider that one of the beginnings of real art, where you think about art as purely an expression, a mode of expression versus the technicalities of being able to actually replicate reality. I think something very similar is happening now. Obviously, generative AI is able to do things that we humans have taken to be something that only we could do for most of human history. And obviously, the place where it's landed with the most noise has been in education, where students could, in theory, or they probably are already using it to cheat on their term papers, their essays, their homework in different ways. I think there's two things at play here. One is this is a tool that is going to stay. Industry, academia is already using it to develop things for research. So obviously part of the reason of an education is to prepare you for the world that you will be in. So to hide from these types of tools that are going to be heavily used in someone's later life, it's not going to be a solid education. And then the other thing is ChatGPT, when it came out, it was not designed for education. It's a very thin layer on top of a large language model. But what we think, and we're working on this, we're developing this as we speak, there are ways to leverage the same underlying technology where not only can you mitigate the cheating risk, but you can actually accelerate a student's ability to get feedback on writing, to be able to brainstorm things, accelerate a teacher or professor's ability to get assessment on how a student's doing. Just a quick vignette on how we're thinking about it. We're creating a modality where teachers can create assignments with the AI. So the AI acts as a teaching assistant, assign it through the AI, and then the student will do the paper, do the assignment with the AI. So the AI says, okay, well, what's your thesis here? What do you want to argue for? Okay, let's come up with some data to back that up. And then give the student feedback, but not, once again, doing it for the student, but giving them good feedback like a writing coach would do. And then when it's time to submit the assignment, as opposed to just submitting the final version, which is typical, now we have a whole record of the conversation with the AI. So it's actually the process can now be submitted to the teacher, and the AI can also help evaluate the essay based on that process. So if a student were to go to ChatGPT and to say, write this essay for me, and copy and paste that onto our AI would tell the professor, hey, this thing just showed up. There was no process here. We should look into that. So I think not only can you mitigate the cheating there, but by focusing on that process, a lot more students are going to get, they're going to be less stuck, and they're going to get a lot more feedback, which we all know makes you a better writer.
And so you're, I think, referring to Khanmigo, right? This is the solution that you guys launched earlier this year.
That's right. We've been working on this a little bit longer than most people would guess. About almost a year ago, OpenAI reached out to us. They said, hey, we're working on our next generation model. It was GPT-4. And they thought that this was the model that was really going to open people's eyes, both get people excited about AI and also maybe a little bit scared about AI. And so it was important for them to launch with what they called social positive use cases. And they saw education and healthcare as the obvious ones. And they contacted us literally 2 weeks before they were done with GPT-4, I believe before some people even in OpenAI had access to it, because they wanted to see if we could, if we were interested. I was skeptical at first because I had paid attention to the space, GPT-2, GPT-3, very interesting, but a lot of hallucinations, made up facts, a lot of, you know, horrible at math, things like that. But after that first weekend, it was pretty obvious that GPT-4 was going to change everything. A few months later, ChatGPT comes out. And for those who aren't expert on the various underlying models, ChatGPT was, and if you get the free version, it still is based on GPT 3.5. And at first I was disappointed when ChatGPT came out. One, we were under NDA with OpenAI. I said, hey, come on, guys. I thought we're going to wait until March of 2023 to launch this. And they said, no, we haven't launched anything. We just launched a chat interface on our old model. But that seems to have gotten people excited ahead of, they didn't even know about GPT-4 yet. In hindsight, I think it was a blessing because with a very imperfect technology, it brought out all of the possibility and a lot of the fears, especially around education. And so we doubled down our effort to mitigate the risks. I just talked about ways that you can mitigate the risks on cheating. But Conmigo, which is our AI built on top of GPT-4, it won't give you the answer. It acts as a Socratic tutor. It acts as a teaching assistant. All conversations are logged and shared with teachers and parents for students who are under 18. We have a second artificial intelligence that moderates the conversations and actively notifies parents and teachers if anything is suspicious. So we think that we're going to be able to harness it primarily for good and really mitigate most of the downsides.
And are you starting to get some early feedback? You know, how do tutors respond to this? How do students and parents respond to working with Conmigo?
Yes, we launched it March 15th, which was when GPT-4 launched. And honestly, we were readying ourselves for a lot of blowback. We thought a lot of folks, obviously artificial intelligence is a bit of a controversial topic. Some, we imagine a lot of folks would get excited, but other folks would say, Khan Academy, why are you jumping in so fast to artificial intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. I have to say the feedback since we launched has been resoundingly positive. And once again, I think that's because ChatGPT got out there, very imperfect, no guardrails in place. Teachers know that students are already using it. And so to a large degree, it was a relief that something higher quality with an education use case in mind was out there. So we started in a limited pilot for 3 months. We got really good feedback. And now for this coming school year, we're ready to have a much broader release in a lot of schools and universities.
I'm fascinated by your design process, Sal. You know, we're obsessed with curiosity, us guys, and Simon Paul and myself. And for us, curiosity is an attitude of wonder with a spirit of exploration. Could you give us a sense of how this is going to change the life of the student? And what does it mean for learning as an individual, do you think?
Yeah, I think we're at the very, very early stages. But one thing that is clear, especially if a student is curious, this type of technology, they're going to be off to the races. At a very high level, we've described Conmigo as a tutor for every student, a teaching assistant for every teacher. And so on the student side, it can do a little bit of your classic tutoring work where a student is stuck on a problem. They can ask Conmigo for help. Conmigo will help in a Socratic way. It won't just tell the student the answer, but help them work through it. We're introducing a sense of memory to Conmigo, so it remembers past interactions. If a student says, why do I need to learn this? Conmigo typically asks something like, well, what do you care about? And then the student has to answer that. But now it'll remember those things. If a student says, hey, you know, we're learning entropy right now in chemistry, but we learned that in physics, and I've also heard that word in computer science. How do these words connect? Conmigo can help with things like that. And then Conmigo, there's a whole set of activities it can do for students, which honestly would have seemed science fiction a year ago, where it can emulate literary characters, historical characters. So students, a curious student can have a conversation with We had a student from India who had a conversation with Jay Gatsby for several hours and then apologized for taking his time from the Great Gatsby. And so, you know, a lot of what I'm sure there's a lot of Trekkies who might be listening, you know, the next generation, the holodeck, where you're there and you're in these simulations, where we could already do that on chat. And I suspect we're going to be able to do that really holodeck style in probably 5 to 10 years. So I think a student's curiosity, you know, the sky's the limit. These modalities where you can write with the AI and then talk to characters. It came from an idea. It was last Christmas break. I was testing some things with my daughter, and I was testing activity where she was writing a story with the AI. The AI was brainstorming with her, but then she would write the sentences. She was writing about a social media influencer who was stuck on a desert island without internet. And at some point, the social media influencer was really stressed that she couldn't share how beautiful the beach was with her friends. And my daughter said, "Hey, could I talk to Samantha?" And like, I don't see why not. So then she asks the AI, "Can I talk to Samantha?" And then the AI took on the persona of the character in the story that my daughter and an AI were constructing together. And I thought, I didn't think this would ever happen in my lifetime. It's spooky, but beautiful in a certain way. And my daughter was reassuring the character that she had created, that it was going to be okay, that she should live in the moment, that it's not just about sharing for other folks. It's about being in the present. And I was like, this is pretty good. And then on the teacher side, obviously can help with lesson plans, grading, brainstorming, help refresh a teacher's knowledge, et cetera.
You touched on it in passing there, Sal, about memory. But that was one of the things when I've been learning around what you've been doing, that the memory feature that you added in there, I think is something you should be super proud of and really impressive. Because in reading up on it and seeing how you introduce memory for personalization around, if you give a student likes football or something, it can then do analogies and do everything in football. If they want short answers or long answers or using emoticons or not, tell us more on some of the things you built in there, because that was something that really impressed me.
You know, so anyone who's used ChatGPT or any of these large language models, you'd know that it essentially only has the context of the conversation that you are in. Essentially, the whole conversation gets passed to the large language model along with some prompting, some other text that whoever has created the application might construct. And then the large language model munches on all those and comes up with the next word and then does the whole thing over again for the word after that, et cetera, et cetera. And so we realize that if you want it to be a meaningful tutor or a meaningful teaching assistant, you know, if I'm a teacher, every time I say, "Hey, can I help me create a lesson plan?" If the AI every time says, "Well, what grade do you teach? And where are your students in the class?" That would be a teaching assistant with only short-term memory. It should remember that you're teaching ninth grade and when you last spoke in previous conversations. And obviously that's very important for the student as well. If they say, "I like football yesterday," it's kind of lame to have to answer that same question again. So yes, we are consolidating the conversations and memory in ways that the AI can access it during future conversations. We're developing it so that the AI can construct insights about the student that, the student likes football, likes to keep shorter responses, you know, is more engaged if I approach things with this tone versus that tone. But one thing that's also very important, we're actually making that transparent to the student so they can see what the AI's insights are about them. And so they can say, I don't always like football. I just was in the mood that day or something like that. So they can also give the AI feedback on, and they can erase it if they think that the AI has, you know, learned too much about them. they can delete it.
You mentioned guardrails earlier, and as you said, sort of OpenAI, when they launched, it's been very vocal about, we're testing this, we're trying to put the guardrails in place, you're testing this with us. What are some of the guardrails that you're really paying attention to, particularly with the work you're doing with Carmigo, but just more broadly, where do you think the guardrails need to be using this technology in education?
You know, and it's especially sensitive because we're one of the first, if not the first, to make this generally available to under 18. Obviously, there's a lot of under 18 who are probably faking their age and using, you know, other platforms, but we're officially for, you know, as young as 7 or 8 year olds. So the first fear, it was interesting, when we first were under a non-disclosure agreement with OpenAI, we had these really intense debates within our organization. Half the organization was really excited about this. We've always wanted to be that personalized tutor for every student on the planet. But half the organization was really worried because this technology, it was infamously bad at math. It would hallucinate facts. We take pride in having high quality information on Khan Academy and being solid at math as well. And then there's just a lot of unknowns. What happens if a student interacts with this type of technology? And, you know, none of us could have predicted 20 years ago that students would go into these rabbit holes on social media and they would get triggered and polarized and get depressed and get bullied. So we don't want that to happen, at least in our version. I mean, we don't want that to happen generally, but we definitely don't want that to happen on Khan Academy. And so the guardrails are, it records every conversation, so it's auditable, and then it's shared with parents and teachers. There's a second artificial intelligence that if it detects the conversation going into a suspicious area, it will actively notify parents and teachers so that they can see what's going on there. The Khanmigo, we have two modes. We have teacher mode and student mode. If you're in student mode, which only students can only be in student mode, it won't give answers. It acts Socratically. It's pretty good at ensuring that it's not being used for cheating. Those are all of the interactions are not, because it's a gray area, an ethical gray area, all of the interactions are not being used to train OpenAI's model right now. That was, to OpenAI's credit, their decision, because they said, look, it's a gray area. We just don't want to go there right now. So there's also, you know, we're very careful there. All of the personally identifiable information is also not going to the underlying artificial intelligence model. So if a student says, oh yeah, I like to go, you know, my name's Michael and I like to go fishing with Samantha. When it goes to the model, it says user 1389 likes to go fishing with user 5842. So we anonymize that. So as you can imagine, we're taking great pains to...
It's teenage proof.
Exactly. That's pedagogically sound. There's a lot of guardrails. There's a lot of safety in place. And we're running tests. We're already running efficacy tests to make sure at first that it's not doing harm, and then hopefully that it's starting to accelerate student learning.
I heard it maybe in a podcast or on another talk, but as I said, if the adage of social media, as you pointed out, is Mark Zuckerberg's move fast and break things, I wonder, you know, what's the adage of you know, working with AI technology? I wonder if it's Festina Ente, you know, make haste slowly. We want to get on with it, but we want to learn as we go a little bit more in a bit of more of a steady way than perhaps we did with social media.
Yeah, what we've been doing in our team is actually we've been kind of moving boldly but responsibly. So every project that we're doing, we're now doing it beyond artificial intelligence, but we started this habit last year when we were exploring this space, is every project, part of the proposal for the project has ethical implications. And then how do we mitigate the potential ethical downsides? And we've been able to essentially, you know, we list the fears, we list all the ethical concerns, and then we try to turn those into features, things that actually make the experience better for students and teachers and parents. I do think, you know, there's worries about, you know, more guardrails, hallucinations, math. There's a lot of work we're doing above and beyond the underlying model to make sure that the math is correct. We're anchoring the content on the Khan Academy content that's already there in most cases. So once again, it's much less likely to hallucinate. But above and beyond that, we also think it's very important for the students to have digital literacy here, to be able to know what these models are, that you can't take everything that the model says as gospel. If you're going to anchor on some data point, you should double check it. You know, we and others, OpenAI, Google, others are also working on ways that it can check its own data a little bit better. I think that's going to happen in the next 6 to 12 months. But I think with all of these guardrails, I don't want to be overly optimistic, but I think we're going to be in a better place than we are in social media or just web search generally. I mean, the internet generally is truly the Wild West. You do a web search, that your top five results are people who paid for the most on the AdWords, and then the next five results are the people who are best at search engine optimization. It's not necessarily the most credible organizations, and so, even before generative AI, we have to teach students how to navigate that. Social media, once again, you're seeing things either from the highest bidder or the content creators who can almost trigger you the most is what that last generation of AIs are giving you. And so it's intentionally pulling you into these rabbit holes. It's intentionally making you feel anxious or angry, which is not good. Or it's going to the highest bidder. You know, here's some new slacks you might want to buy between between your anger and what the other things that you just saw. I have better hopes for generative AI. In some ways, it's more of a closed system, and it's more of a curated system in interesting ways.
In your TED talk, Sal, you talk about how it can not only give people access to this sort of this personalized tutor that can be so advantageous, but also some of the other use cases that you've built in as well around a life coach, a career coach, a guidance counselor. Can you tell us about some of those broader roles as well of how you see it playing out?
Yeah, and I want to be clear. I don't think any of this, even though we often will talk about Conmigo as a tutor or as a guidance counselor, as a life coach, I don't see it as a replacement for having those things. But we know in most students' lives, those are scarce resources. Here in the United States, guidance counselors, you have one guidance counselor for every 200 or 300 students. So you're lucky if you have a half an hour conversation about where you might want to go to university, and then they kind of, and then you leave and you don't really get to spend a lot of time. If you need help with a life coaching, even if you're lucky enough to have a life coach, which is very expensive, you might talk to them once a week. You're not going to be able to talk to them in the moment when you might be going through something, or you might be afraid to talk to them about something. And so we have activities on Conmigo where absolutely it's a life coach. You can ask it questions like, how can I do better with procrastination? Or can you give me help with my test-taking anxiety? Or, my parents want me to do this, but I want to do that. Help me here. So students can have those types of conversations, which we think is really valuable. And we're starting to work with some education psychologists. I won't say just whom yet. We're going to announce shortly. But some of the world's top educational psychologists who've created interventions that are research-based, but they're still very expensive. Historically, you have to hire an education psychologist. They'll come in with a group of 20 or 30 students, and they'll run a one-hour, two-hour intervention. So you can imagine that would cost several hundreds of dollars for just that one classroom. But they're testing it on Conmigo, and this one education psychologist, she's very prominent. She said, this runs the intervention better than I do. and so I think there's going to be some real possibility of scaling things that were very scarce before.
Now, that's fascinating. When you talk about coaching, psychology, therapy, and the support networks that need to be in place for learning, for example, or just life coaching and so on, when you think that the AI is learning enough to create an experience that is better than maybe a human-led experience. What does this all mean for the teachers and the role of teaching in education, do you think so?
I'm very optimistic. I think it elevates the role of the teacher in the way that the teacher wants. I think anyone who goes into education, they have fantasies of being able to inspire their students, being able to form that connection, that student who's not confident turning him or her around. And then when they're in their 30s or 40s saying, that was the teacher. That was the teacher that made me believe in myself, who got me excited about that subject. And that does happen. But we also know that teachers have to do a lot of other things that don't lead to that. They have to do a lot of lesson planning. They have to do a lot of grading papers. They know that in a classroom with 25, 30, 35 students, a lot of those students have individual needs. And the teacher wishes they could copy themselves and have one-on-one conversations with many of those students, but they seldom have time. And so in our early pilots, we're seeing the teachers feeling like it's saving them time and energy, which they need for themselves. Globally, teachers are getting burned out. And then they're also seeing that it's able to answer questions that in many cases, the students were afraid to ask, and also be able to get to the student in the moment. But it's freeing up the teacher to be able to do more of what only a human being can do: inspire the classroom, sit next to students, do small group interactions, and also get the student classes really excited. Teachers are going at the front of the classroom. If they're about to do a lesson on the Civil War, they can tell the classroom, hey, everyone, we have a special guest, Abraham Lincoln. Let's have a conversation with President Lincoln. And you can imagine that's, maybe the novelty is very high right now, but I think that there will always be a certain fun to doing something like that, even when kids get a little bit more used to generative AI.
So we're talking with Sal Khan. Sal's the founder and CEO of Khan Academy, a not-for-profit educational organization with a mission to provide a free, world-class education for anyone, anywhere. Sal is a former hedge fund analyst who created Khan Academy in 2008. Today, the platform provides courses in various subjects to millions of learners globally, played a vital role throughout the pandemic to support access to online education. Sal's innovative approach to education has earned him recognition as a leading figure in the edtech industry, and he continues to innovate, as we were just hearing, with the impact of things like Khanmigo and adoption of new technologies like generative AI. So, Sal, let's backtrack a bit. So could you tell us the story of how and why you created Khan Academy?
Yeah, and when you just mentioned 2008, that was when I set it up as like a formal not-for-profit, but it really started in 2004. I was, as you mentioned, an analyst at a hedge fund. I was a year out of business school, but my original background was in technology. But I just got married, and my cousin Nadia, who was 12 years old at the time, she was visiting the Northeast, visiting me in Boston after my wedding. And it just came out of conversation that she was having trouble in math. I offered to tutor her when she went back to New Orleans, which is where I was born and raised as well. And she agreed. And I just started tutoring her every day after work, after school for her. And slowly but surely, she got caught up with her class, even got a little ahead of her class. And at that point, I became what I call a tiger cousin. I called up her school. I said, yeah, I really think Nadia, she had been put into a slower math track. So I said, I really think she should be able to retake the placement exam. They said, who are you? I said, I'm her cousin. And they let her. And the same Nadia who was in that slower track was then put into an advanced track. So I was hooked. I started tutoring her younger brothers. Word spreads in my family. Free tutoring is going on. And before I know it, I'm working with about 10, 15 cousins, family, friends every day after work. And the pattern I saw was that my cousins, for the most part, they were working hard and they were bright, but they had gaps in their knowledge. And it wasn't rocket science to think about where those gaps came from. In a traditional academic model, let's say you're learning multiplying decimals and you get an 80% on an exam. Too bad. You didn't know 20%. The class will move on to the next topic. Usually something that builds on that. Maybe, you know, story problems, word problems using decimals, or now you're going to go to dividing decimals, or, you know, who knows what else. And that just keeps happening in most folks' education, especially in a topic like math that's very cumulative. And usually around an algebra class or trigonometry class or calculus class, to understand that equation, you have to understand everything else that came before it really fluently. You need to know your decimals, your logarithms, your exponents, your negative numbers, fluent fractions, fluently. But most students don't, because they had a 20% gap here, 10% gap there. And so they really struggle with their algebra, their trigonometry. And you see that happening globally in school systems. That's where kids really hit a wall. There's no way you're going to be able to get that equation right if you're not super fluent with dividing decimals or negative numbers or exponents. So I started writing software for my cousins to give them practice to get that fluency. And that was the first Khan Academy. This was now 2005. And it was in 2006 that a friend suggested, when he saw that I was making the software for my cousins, he said, well, how are you scaling your lessons? I said, no, it's hard to scale my lessons with 15 cousins. You know, it was much better when I only had one or two. And my friend suggested I should record lessons for them on YouTube. I initially thought it was a horrible idea. You know, I was very enamored with the technology, the technological side of it. Video seemed very old school. But I did it. I uploaded onto YouTube. My cousins famously told me they liked me better on YouTube than in person. I believe what they were saying is they liked the interest that I was taking in their life. We were still doing the phone calls, but when they're doing their homework at 11 p.m., or I wasn't available, or if they forgot something from fifth grade and they were in ninth grade, they didn't have to feel embarrassed. So that's what they really liked about the videos, but they still really liked having me in their life. And then many people who are not my cousins started watching and using. And so by 2008, we had on the order of about 50 to 100,000 folks who were using it per month. And that's when I said, oh, this feels like a real thing. I set it up as a not-for-profit, as you mentioned, free world-class, a mission, free world-class education for anyone, anywhere. And then it was 2009. Even in 2008, I liked my job. It's not one of these, you know, jobs that I was just dying to leave. But in 2009, Khan Academy had kind of taken over my life. And so that's when I took the plunge, quit my day job. My wife was training to be a doctor at the time. So we had to live off of savings. So that was hard for that year. But by the end of that year, by fall of 2010, was when we got our first significant philanthropic support to become a real organization.
What's amazing, and so many things I want to talk to you about. When I remember some of those original videos, you have a great, you know, you're a great teacher, Sal. It's amazing how you structure these complex ideas, break it down, make it very simple. And then there's all the visual stuff, and it really kind of landed, even, you know, you taught me fractions again, if I can say. But the other thing that really strikes me about this conversation is when you mentioned Boston, because, you know, we also have backgrounds in Boston with MIT, Cambridge, at Boston University. There's such an amazing amount of incredible understanding about education that seems to have come out of that space in the last 40, 50 years. You know, you can think of like Peter Zanke, just for one, and all those impacts on what education is and almost how it was ahead of the game, the work that was coming out of Boston in terms of what is education going to be in the future. I mean, it's just so much from there. What you've shared in the past, your earliest days were research-backed and pedagogy and learning science have underpinned this platform. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it was interesting. In the early days of Khan Academy, I won't claim that I was very up to speed on the learning science literature. I wasn't. I was acting on intuition. I was acting on things that I knew had worked well for myself. I had background all the way back in high school where I used to be a peer tutor. And I saw the same patterns that I just described, that a lot of students were struggling. If they just had someone sit down with them, help them fill in their gaps, those same students, not only would they catch up, but oftentimes became advanced students. And then I saw that same pattern with my cousin. So I took a very pragmatic approach. Obviously, the way that I learned and thought about these concepts had worked for me in my life. And then I found that when I was able to share that with other folks, that they also were able to go off to the races, especially in topics like math and science. Later on, as Khan Academy developed, did I learn that I wasn't the first person to realize, you know, these gaps that are forming in people's knowledge. There's a whole literature about mastery learning, which many educators have been saying for rough, you know, the term was coined about 40 years ago, but the idea is arguably the oldest way of learning. Piano teachers have been having students practice their scales for hundreds of years. I'm sure if you were to go...
I'm a pianist. Hey,
oh, there you go. Hunter-gatherers for tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, I'm sure said, hey, you know, you got to practice stringing that bow a little bit more. It's not okay to only do that at an 80% level. And actually the non-mastery learning, which is now the standard, this became commonplace during the Industrial Revolution. Very... utopian idea around mass public education, which, you know, it happened in country, you know, places like England and Germany and the US, and it helped and it's done a lot of positive things, but they had to make a compromise. So they batch students together 25, 30 at a time, apply some lectures to them, apply some homework to them. Some kids are getting it. Some kids get an 80, 90%. Some kids get a 60, 70%, but the line has to keep moving just like the Industrial Revolution. So, you know, I later learned much more of like, okay, people have been thinking about this, but the reason why ideas like mastery learning and personalization, even though there had been decades of efficacy research on it, hadn't become mainstream is that there's no economically practical way to do it without the help of technology. And I think what's interesting about Khan Academy is we came on right as, obviously the internet had already been there, but on-demand video was becoming much more affordable to deliver. We were able to, I think, bring our own special sauce to not just the videos, but also just how the personalization is done. And then, yeah, now it's hitting another gear with things like generative AI. I will say one thing about the Boston connection, which, you know, I wouldn't make light of, which is a lot of universities purport to teach their students ethics. You know, they'll have classes on ethics. They'll have discussions on ethics. But when push comes to shove, the universities themselves don't always do the right thing. And in the late 90s, when the internet had just come around, it was already obvious to a lot of folks that this could be very valuable for education. But most of higher education, at least in the United States at the time, they were looking at ways to profit off of this. They were partnering with for-profit organizations and they were creating online courses, but they were charging for these. These online courses, they were charging the same tuition that they were charging for their in-person courses, $10,000, $20,000 a year. And I remember, I believe it was in 1999 or 2000, and I didn't know at that time that my life was going to go down this path in education. I just saw a press release from MIT announcing their open courseware initiative. And at the time that other universities were announcing their paid degree programs, MIT said, with our own money, we are going to record every class at MIT, and we are just, and every problem set and every course note, every course material, and we're just going to share it for free for the world. And I remember at that time when I saw it, that's where I did my undergrad, I couldn't have been more inspired. I said, this is how you teach people ethics, by actually doing it. And so when Khan Academy a few years later, 6-7 years later, was catching on, and I was getting letters from folks saying I was helping them, I almost felt dirty if I didn't hold myself to the same standard that MIT had held itself to. So I think that was a big inspiration for me to say, I want Khan Academy to essentially stand for the same thing.
That's amazing.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
So, Sal, with arguably education is probably one of, if not the most important priorities for us globally. Are you seeing the system working, and is, in a way, the fact that we need Khan Academy a sort of symptom of maybe that the system isn't providing what is needed there with the level of support that ideally people would need? And I guess you sort of hinted at it a bit with the ideal model would be personal tuition. Obviously, that's not affordable. Is this the solution that sort of fixes the model as it stands today?
I won't claim that it's going to fix it on its own or it's a silver bullet, but we believe, and now we actually have a lot of data that we think it can actually substantially move the dial in the right direction, in the right context, when it's used appropriately. And once again, this isn't a finger point at the school system. If you told me 50 or 60 years ago, here's a class of 30 students, educate them as well as you can, I would have had to do very similar practices as, hopefully what some good teachers have been doing for hundreds of years, where even then, you want to do some lecture, but then you want to do some group problem solving, some Socratic dialogue. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to give a test. The kids are going to take that test. And to some degree, you have to move on, because it's very hard for a traditional teacher to, for the students who haven't gotten 100% yet, to say, oh, well, why don't you keep working on that while the other groups, and then I'll give you another test, and I'm going to grade you another test next week. It's not realistic. Even though for decades, education schools have been saying, you should try to do differentiated instruction and sometimes even mastery learning, having multiple chances for students to develop fluency. But it would have been very hard. But now we have the tools, obviously things like on-demand video and personalized practice with immediate feedback, data dashboards for teachers. And now all of that, we think, takes on a whole new level with generative AI. So not only are we building it, we're putting that out there in the field. We're doing a lot of efficacy studies to make sure that it's moving the dial. And even before generative AI, when students are putting in about 20 hours a year on Khan Academy, which isn't a lot, 20 hours per year, those students, based on the studies we've seen, there's 50 plus studies that we're probably the most studied platform because we're so open. But those students are getting accelerated 20, 30, 40, 50, 60%, which is, in any world, very significant.
So you wrote this brilliant article in The Economist end of last year, where you're bringing to life these ideas around personalization and mastery. And you're talking about how Alexander the Great had Aristotle as his personal tutor. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could all have Aristotle as our personal tutor? Though I think getting that voice represented through the AI is going to take some doing. But if we're asking you to stare into your crystal ball for a moment, where do you see some of this going in the future, in 6 months, 2 years, probably even 2 years is a long way out? Are we likely to be able to have our own Einstein teach us physics on demand?
Yeah, it's funny that you're saying 6 months, because historically, like, 6 months would be nothing. Most even fast moving tech organizations are kind of thinking 9 months, 12 months out, but things are moving so fast now. So for example, we talked about, we're giving it a sense of memory. We're all familiar with text-to-speech. Obviously, we can talk to our devices, Alexa and Siri and all of that. But the text-to-speech that we are now able to access, it is exciting and scary. it's hard to tell that this is not a human being on the other side of it, which is great for the use cases we're talking about. It's scary for things like fraud and phishing attacks, et cetera, et cetera. But let's not go there.
Well, Sal, we can confirm, because we're looking at you, that he really is Sal Khan on this podcast. Yeah.
So you believe.
So we believe.
But even pre-generative AI, it's always a leap of faith that other people are sentient. But anyway, we don't have to get too metaphysical. So you're going to be able to have conversations with AI, even though a lot of this generative AI, people talk about them as large language models. The latest models are actually able to input imagery and create imagery and language. So it starts to blur the lines between generative AI and for images and generative AI for language, which is very exciting, where you're going to be able to walk around, point your phone at something, and you know, you're going to have a tour guide as Aristotle or whoever it might be, to be able to talk about what's there, and not just simple pattern match. You know, there's been some, I've seen some demos where a very complicated municipal pipes at a city, you can imagine there's hundreds of pipes going in different directions, and someone just took a picture of it, and they asked the AI, what does this pipe do? And they just point an arrow at one of the pipes, and it just is able to figure out what it's able to do. You know, something that even master plumbers, based on just that picture, are usually would struggle what it's doing. So imagine everyone having that with them. I think you're probably 2-3 years away. So you could Zoom with the AI. There might be a Sal AI. There might be maybe historical characters, or just new entities that people want to interact with. But you can imagine in 5 or 10 years, we've all seen the demos of Apple's latest headset that's going to come out in the not too far future. I don't think that's going to be mainstream in 6 months, but in 5 to 10 years, you could imagine being transported to ancient Rome and interacting with the citizens. And some of them might be other people, but some of them could be generative AI. And it's going to be hard to tell who's who. You're going to be able to take, I don't know if you all have seen the cartoon, The Magic School Bus, where the school bus, you can go into the circulatory system, or you can travel through time, or you can go into the brain. We're going to be able to do that. We're going to be able to take field trips together into the heart or whatever else. So it really is kind of wild where we're getting. It's exciting. It's, things that I didn't think were going to happen in my lifetime are going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years.
Outside of AI, what is the Khan Academy currently curious about beyond all of this, Sal?
I'm glad you asked that, because these days everyone's so excited about generative AI. I was actually having some conversation. I was just in the UK, and I was having some conversations with folks in education there, and they're eager to start piloting Khanmigo, start piloting the generative AI. And I kept reinforcing, I was like, we're very excited about the generative AI, but we're actually most excited about when the generative AI is there to assist you on your core Khan Academy work. Because these 50 plus efficacy studies we've talked about, these have been done on, let's call it classic Khan Academy, where students are working, they're getting the exercises, they're able to solve them at their own time and pace. If they have trouble, there's hints, there's videos, teachers are notified how the students are doing and what they might want to do to help get students along. And so when an AI is used as an overlay on that, because still the generative AI, it's not coming up with a year-long sequence of lessons, and it's not there yet. So when it's anchored on core Khan Academy, we think that's where it works best. And what, we've had these 50 plus efficacy studies where students are able to put in 18, 19, 20 hours a year. They're accelerating pretty dramatically. But one big question mark was always, all right, it's plausible, but how do we get it happening in a mainstream school system where all kids are learning at that level? And most recently, you're going to hear more about this, but Newark, New Jersey, for those who aren't familiar, Newark, New Jersey is not a special case school system. It's a large urban school district in the U.S. With all of the opportunities and problems of any large urban school district. And they just started using classic Khan Academy, pre-generative AI, in November. And at the end of this last school year, 70% of their students were at a level of engagement, at a level of dosage that should lead to the type of results that I've just described, a pretty dramatic acceleration. And so I'm pretty excited about that, because there's actually very little evidence of a whole school district moving by potentially double-digit percentage acceleration. I'm not aware of that happening in my lifetime. And so if that works, great. And they're also now piloting generative AI. If the generative AI can make it happen even better, even better.
So one question about yourself. What are you personally curious about at the moment?
I've made my little comment about, consciousness, the leap of faith. But I've always been very curious about the nature of reality, which I guess is the ultimate thing to be curious about. And I would say about 7 or 8 years ago, really out of necessity, I was getting very claustrophobic on planes, and it was really happening. I was getting stressed for various reasons. My kids were small and a lot was going on at work, et cetera. I started meditating, and now I take it very seriously. And so for me, that kind of inward journey of consciousness, the mind and the brain. And I think it touches on generative AI. A lot of folks say, well, this is just coming up with the next best word. And I'm like, well, what are you doing? When I'm talking right now, there are neurons that are just literally giving you the next word. I'm almost just sitting and watching and just seeing like, what is this Sal large language model going to produce next? Like, what's the next word that comes out of his mouth? And, a lot of meditation is to learn to observe your thoughts and to realize that you aren't your thoughts, and that you even aren't your ego, you aren't your identity. These are all thoughts of sorts that you've constantly primed yourself with, and they keep getting, feeding back to yourself. But then when you separate your awareness from them, they lose their power in a lot of ways. And it's interesting because even with large language models, I mean, you talk about the future. If this Neuralink and all this other stuff happens, it probably in 10 years, large language models are just going to feel like more thoughts in your head. They're not going to feel like, but I think it tells us a lot about ourselves, about even what our own thoughts are, because the people and who are most miserable in life are the folks who can't disassociate themselves from their own thoughts. They're trapped in their own thoughts. And so maybe these models will help us understand ourselves a little bit better. But yes, that's something I'm very curious about. I think it's the ultimate thing to be curious about, is that kind of inward journey about what consciousness is.
Sounds like there's a whole other episode we could do there on consciousness and through to sentience and where all of that takes us. So we've covered a lot there, Sal. So we've gone from how the impact of ChatGPT, how you've used AI, how teachers are creating assignments with AI and students are using AI, and then taking us through Carmigo and some of the incredible progress you've made there. We talked about how you've mitigated the risks, the guardrails, whether that's through cheating, whether that's through having a second AI actively monitoring what's actually being done, and then if needed, notifying and bringing in parents or teachers. We've heard around how AI can play the role or at least support things like guidance counseling and life coaches, where maybe students don't have access to these at all or to the level that maybe is desirable. And the impact it will have on teachers, that actually it shouldn't be a threat. It actually can help elevate the role of the teacher and be a real benefit for how they can have an impact. We've heard how you got into creating Khan Academy from tutoring in maths after school and exploring men into YouTube videos when you could no longer service your 10 or 15 cousins with all of the needs, and how that then scaled through to the millions of people that are now being helped by Khan Academy. And then some of the impact as well, which is super impressive, how even just 20 hours a year can have 20, 30, up to 60% accelerated impact for people, which is super impressive and something you and your team, I'm sure, should be and are very, very proud of that impact you're having on people's education. And then a little bit of a look to the future as well and where things are going. So a lot we covered there, Sal. If there's one message for people to take away from all of that, what would be the one takeaway for people?
Be cautiously excited about the world we're in. Life is too short to not try to enjoy it. And we are in exciting times, but there's definitely things to be cautious about too.
Cautiously excited. Love it. Thank you so much for joining us, Sal.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. If you're interested in knowing how curious your organization is, then our new organizational curiosity diagnostic developed with PolTF will help. For more info, head over to curiousadvantage.com for more details. And the Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, or audiobook copy now to further explore the 7Cs model for being more curious. We're always curious to hear from you, so use the hashtag Curious Advantage. And we do encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel and join the conversation. If you enjoyed our conversation today, do make sure not to miss out on future podcast episodes. So make sure you subscribe today and keep exploring curiously.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.